to this town today. It's hopefully going to be, I'm sure I shouldn't say hopefully, it's definitely going to be enlightening and informative and empower us to serve a very important community amongst us. This is abuse in LDS culture, and today we are privileged to hear from Terrence Alday, who served on the Washington State University faculty for 32 years, where he was a science writer in agricultural and family sciences. Yes, ma'am. Megan Rains, who has worked as the director of domestic violence services and case manager for Autumn House Domestic Violence Shelter in Mesa, Arizona. Jenny Morrow is a licensed marriage and family therapist who has provided therapy services for Arch and Family Services in Living, Utah. And Lisa Tensmeyer Hansen is an associate licensed marriage and family therapist and doctoral candidate in the same field at BYU. So I will turn the time over to our experts.
Thank you, and thank all of you for being here. I'm curious how many of you attended the previous session on this same topic. Okay, and how many of you did not? Almost evenly divided. It'll be necessary to repeat some of the former one, but just in a brief overview so that you have an idea of what the major points are in the presentation that I made. I'm very pleased to be sitting here with three professional family counselors, and my wife reminds me we need to keep this microphone just about an inch from our mouth, and if we don't, they might not hear it back there. So the topic today, Bones Heal Faster, Emotional Abuse in LDS Families, is not talked about enough in the church. And my major motivation in the research and in making this presentation has been a very strong feeling that emotional abuse is not broadly enough recognized in the church, either by members or by leaders, especially at the local level. And so I felt that I would do some research and speak up. My background is as a science writer in both agricultural and family sciences. I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist or any other ologist, but it was a very difficult topic to research. I had as well to the professionals in the field who work with abusers and victims day in and day out. A lot of fortitude and courage for them to do that. The one reason this topic is so important is because of the place that family takes in the doctrine of the church. The Family Proclamation of the World proclaims the role of families as an essential element in God's great plan of happiness, also known as the plan of salvation. And we teach that we cannot be saved as individuals, but only as members of eternally sealed families. And I believe marriage truly is God's plan for great happiness, not just in the eternities beyond, but here and now in this mortal life. I would that it were always so. The sad truth is that many marriages, even many temple marriages, are not the happy adventure that a kindly Heavenly Father intends for His children, but they are literal battleground fields strewn with the carnage of unrighteous dominion. Some authorities describe intimate terrorism as a two-person civil war that often results when wounding quarrels become a way of life in a formerly happy marriage. This my presentation is based on several years of research and writing that culminated in Bones Heal Faster, Spousal Abuse in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, published by Dialogue in the spring of 2013. In 40 years of local leadership in the church up in Pullman, Washington, I came to realize that the difficulties of marriages of many Mormons. And of course, up there with many student families, there are additional pressures on them. But all marriages face some difficulties, and I slowly came to understand that spousal abuse is far more common than most Latter-day Saints realize, and that it often is unrecognized and poorly dealt with by bishops and state presidents, and that sometimes inept handling of reports exacerbates the abuse, and not a few victims leave the church because of it. And abuse is an ugly word for ugly acts of violence, especially when directed against family members, and uglier still when perpetrated by Christians who espouse the Savior's gospel of love. It's also a very broad topic. And I hope the poster of the crying woman holding the theatrical mask causes you to ponder. And after the other panelists have made their presentation, I would invite you to share your thoughts about that particular image and its relevance, if any. I break my presentation into one, a definition. We're not talking about the normal conflict in families, the power struggles that go on in all marriages. We're talking about concerted attempts to control another person. He was the counselor in the First Presidency, James E. Faust, acknowledged that there is just cause for breaking marriage covenant. He said that it should be nothing less serious than a prolonged and apparently irredeemable relationship, which is destructive of a person's dignity as a human being. So that's what we're talking about here. In the earlier presentation, I gave examples of emotional abuse. A major point that I make is that bones heal faster. People often don't take emotional abuse seriously. And a friend of mine who was very severely abused, both physically and mentally, who suffered broken bones and abuse from her husband, commented to me one day that bones heal faster, and talked with the director of a clinic who said that a great many women would agree with that. So that's the other thing that we want to call attention to, is that emotional abuse can be every bit as serious or even more serious than physical abuse. Very quickly here, emotional abuse harms mind, body, and spirit. And it can contribute to or cause major depressive disorder. We used to call it clinical depression. Or PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I focus some on both of those. And if you have questions later, we can talk about some of that during the open period here. PTSD is a very real, even life-threatening disorder. And it's not just a diagnosis du jour that happens to be popular right now. I was surprised in my research to find that growing body of research is focused on physical consequences of the emotional abuse. Researchers in Spain and Italy have found that traumatic stress can modify the structural and functional aspects of the brain in adults, leading to any number of psychiatric disorders. And also to discover that perinatal psychobiologists in London are studying the damaging effects of maternal stress on brain development in fetuses. Yeah, that just, I hadn't even imagined such a thing. Maternal stress impacts fetal brain development. And I eagerly await more information about that. There are both spiritual and social consequences of abuse. I talked about the church's response and I was criticized by one of my own brothers who was abused by his wife, his first wife, and by some in the session just before this who asked questions about the inverse of abuse of women by their husbands. And it definitely happens both ways. 1 in 4 women, according to national data and a BYU professor's analysis, either has been or will be abused in their partnership sometime during their life. And I'm sure it's equal with men, but the data doesn't exist much with men. And moving on, I call for some changes in the way the church addresses spousal abuse, and that it would apply to both male and female perpetrators. I urge that that they provide better training for bishops and state presidents and greater education for members, especially for parents. I talked about, quoted several general authorities about the absolute unacceptable nature of abuse of any kind, and that it's contrary to the gospel. And I gave some information out about premarital education, which I will very briefly explain, is a formal curriculum that precedes, hopefully, in the best cases, it precedes the decision to marry, but just when people are dating and so on. So when people are dating at that age, they should be getting premarital education. BYU provides some of this, but only 61% of LDS have some college education, and only 18% have a four-year degree, so we can't rely entirely on attendance of the university, the church universities to provide it. One study found that premarital satisfaction increases with the number of hours in the class up to 10 hours, and it can reduce the risk of divorce by 31%. My pages got mixed up here. Premarital counseling involves one-on-two counseling, a counselor and a couple who are either contemplating the proposal or who are engaged to be married. And it involves specific information about them and their backgrounds and what issues this might raise in a marriage between them, not general in the population, but between them. And the church provides neither of these types of preparation. Then I talked about things that families can do themselves, because ultimately it is the family's responsibility to teach their children. And the most important thing that any couple can do to prevent their children from getting into an abusive marriage or being an abuser themselves is to provide in their home a healthy, happy, spiritual marriage, free of abuse. And with that, I'll turn the microphone over to the next speaker. Who wants to go next?
Miss Lisa.
Do these mics work?
Yes, I think it does. Try it. You have to get it just about an inch from your mouth.
Yes. My name is Lisa Hansen. I work with many families who have experienced many different kinds of abuse.
Here are the Moses.
Just like you're going to pick a bite out.
Wow. And actually, like...
Like a pop star.
Given that as LDS people, we have not improved much on the larger culture as far as our domestic violence, intimate partner violence, emotional abuse statistics, I find myself asking the question, what is it that we have adopted from a larger culture that makes it possible for abuse to continue? I've long believed that our beliefs about God influence our closest family relationships. People who experience God as demanding and dissatisfied, and yet who still seek to please Him, cannot help but perpetuate the same demanding dissatisfaction in their relationship with their spouses, their children, and even themselves. People who see God as full of mercy and enthusiasm for the creativity of humankind toward good ends tend to project those same qualities into their closest relationships. I also believe that our beliefs about appropriate institutional relationships deeply inform our family interactions. What we believe about institutions affects how we see our spouses, children, and ourselves. I have often heard military vets express dismay that their families can't be run more like the efficient machine is military, where everyone knows their place and performs what is expected. What we believe about institutional relationships spills over into our personal lives. With this in mind, I want to take what might appear to be a strange twist to the topic of emotional abuse in close relationships. Because my name appeared last on the little list, I thought I would go at the end, and this would be the final twist. One of the most perplexing characteristics of emotional abuse is that the people who are most at risk for its consequences are the people least likely to see it. We see it more easily from the outside than anyone who's experiencing it on the inside, which is why it often takes years for people who are its victims to become its survivors. People who are most whipped about by manipulation, for example, are those least likely to recognize it. I want to share with you a detailed letter regarding emotional abuse. It was published in Anderson and Allred's Case Reports of the Mormon Alliance and represents one person's response to an actual event. There are a few aspects of this case that might suggest it not to be quite on point for this session. The letter is written by a man about an event perpetrated by a man that most people would say does not rise to the level of abuse. However, it speaks directly to the heart of why emotional spousal abuse cannot be separated from the larger culture. What we believe spells out in our relationships. Before I begin talking about this particular case, I They do not need to ignore the larger, horrific experiences of victims of more overt abuse, particularly sexual abuse, which is where I spend most of my time. It's estimated, based on FBI estimates, that one in three women will be sexually abused in her lifetime, and that many of these will go unreported, that the women will carry the rest of their lives the sense that they are somehow shamed because they caused it. If we could calculate the loss of women's sense of purpose, of their ability to create, of their ability to move forward, we would be astounded. In almost any group you are in, if you look around and say, wow, there's three women, likely one of them has been sexually abused. So as you teach primary, if you happen to be a music person, which I am, and you're teaching a song like, I'm so glad that Daddy comes home, or when my father calls me quickly, I'll obey, perhaps you will be a little bit more careful and concerned that there are women in your audience who experience that differently. Or in a lesson on the priesthood, where a young man has been abused by his priesthood leader, where he's told that priesthood leaders always act in people's best interests. A lot of these things will come. Okay, I wanted to say that because those are really of concern to me before I begin. This is a letter written by a man named Jack. And the reason I believe he is so attuned to what is emotional abuse is because he was abused by a priesthood leader when he was young. And his story is detailed in this book. But I wanted to read you the letter that he wrote to a state president following an incident at a young woman's camp. I'll read you what he says about the incident at the camp. During the summer of 1991, Brittany and Brendan McAllister, they're the children of the author of the letter, attended a state young women's camp. The girls asked their mother to attend, and with a reluctant okay from the young women's president, she did. The mother, whose name was Meredith, accustomed to the disorder and turmoil of a large family, took more easily to the normal camp rowdiness than some of the state leaders, teasing and joking the girls into a good humor. One afternoon, before an activity was scheduled to commence, the girls were running through the woods, seeking relief from the scorching Oklahoma heat by an impromptu water fight with squirt bottles, one of my favorite activities at girls' camp. The adult board leaders overreacted, called the girls to order, scolded them harshly, and threatened to cancel the rest of the camp. The girls, upset, yelled back at the restraint, and in gathering that night around the campfire, and again the next night's testimony meeting, were scolded by the leaders. Stan Powell, who was present, listened intently to the exchanges but said nothing. The women leaders were nervous, continually glancing at him. I'm going to skip now over to the letter. This is a letter from the father. State President, remember when we talked together about the girls' camp issue? I asked, urged, and pleaded with you to please conduct an objective inquiry into the girls' point of view of what happened at camp, since neither you nor I was there to observe firsthand. I wanted you to approach the matter in a spirit of love rather than anger when you had the time and willingness. I'm still waiting for your response. And he talks about what it's like being father of daughters. He said, I'm greatly troubled by the subsequent harm that has been done to our children by church leaders. In my opinion, there is unfinished business that needs your attention with the Silver Board girls. How do you explain to them why the president of the state charged into the middle of an issue limited to the girls and their local leaders within the ward? My unresolved questions to you are, one, see if you can tell why I think these illustrate what happens with emotional abuse. Why did you deny any of the girls a chance to express their feelings to you as an objective, compassionate leader, either before, during, or after the emotional confrontation at girls' camp? Number two, why were you unwilling to listen to them in a spirit of love and understanding? Instead, you chose to command them to repent for something you only heard about from others with no background understanding. What really caused you to interpret what happened at camp as a serious sin rather than as a youthful, innocent inability to express their honest feelings of anger and frustration? Did you express a sincere interest in the problem as they felt about it? Why were their concerns less valid than others you chose to listen to before you confronted them that morning? What were the girls trying to draw the attention of their leaders to in the best way they know how? Was their purpose to bring awareness of personal relationship problems that could benefit from open discussion? Why weren't they allowed to focus on something that had the potential to heal their wounds of misunderstanding? This father then outlines 10 more pertinent questions that say to me how he understood how emotional abuse comes up in families. Seeing women as something other than themselves contributes to a culture that demeans women as equals. This feels to me like just the tip of the iceberg I want to talk about, but I want to move directly into what I think part of the solution is. Secrecy favors perpetrators. We talk a lot in our culture about things that we think will benefit and things that we think are problems. The amount of time we spend talking about emotional and physical abuse in our culture is woefully inadequate for the incidents. For 1 in 3 women to experience something that continues to affect her and detract from her life means we need to spend more time. In every interview, I believe a leader should ask, have you been abused by someone close to you? Has anything happened to you that you believe you need to keep a secret? Regularly, leaders need to say something about spousal abuse. Regularly. As often as they talk about how important it is to go on missions. Because until women feel like it is something that can be talked about without they're looking like they're the problem, they will not bring it up. The phone number for people to call for helplines should be posted and talked about regularly. In every interview a bishop conducts with women in the ward, that should be pointed out as though it's important, even if a woman isn't experiencing it. Because of the institutional differences between power exercised by men and women. And by that I mean men are taught how to lead women in the church, but women are never taught how to lead men in the church, and that creates a disparity. Every man who exercises any kind of power over a woman should be taught to talk about abuse, to make it open, and to make it normal for a woman to talk about her experiences. Not just in relief society, even though most women would be reluctant to bring it up there, because it's still involves shame. Until the people in power make it less shameful. And that needs to happen. There needs to be more talk about it, more openness, more posting. If we talked about it as much as we talked about pornography, for example, women would feel like it was more normal to talk about. We need to send a clear message that when we find out about abuse, it will not be tolerated. That no woman will come talk to a bishop about it. And what we know is that women do not leave relationships until they talk to a bishop first. In the church, that's the pattern. A woman does not gather up and leave without trying to get permission from her ecclesiastical leader. And bishops should be taught to not say anything that sends the woman back home to endure further abuse, or to instill self-doubt in the woman who comes. Oh, I can say a lot more, but I'm just stop at this point and I'll wait for the others to talk, and then we'll have questions.
Hi, my name is
is Jenny Morrow, and I am a licensed marriage and family therapist here in Salt Lake. I'm currently in private practice. And I've been doing therapy about 8 years now, and sat in about 8,000 sessions. So after a lot of sitting behind closed doors with people, I don't know, you start seeing things about the world you just didn't know were happening. So after, you know, my first year or two of therapy, I started really wondering, what is it that's going on? Because being here in Utah, I was working mostly with LDS clients, and what I was finding is that there was still a lot of emotional abuse, there was a lot of addiction issues. So all those things that I had grown up believing I would be protected from in the church, suddenly I was seeing that was actually not the case, that was not true. And so I became somewhat curious and fascinated. Fascinated sounds like a positive word, and it somewhat was, in the sense that I just became really curious about, what is this really about? What is it that leaves people open to the vulnerability of being abused? What is it that leaves people open to the vulnerability of being a perpetrator? Because the things I had been taught would protect from that, you know, I wasn't seeing protecting. So I'm not going to text here, but I do have my notes on my phone. Unless I get a text come through, maybe I'll text as I present. No, I don't know. Okay, so a couple of books that might be interesting, and I didn't bring either of them, pardon me, wishing I had now, I could read a little bit, but there's an interesting book called Spiritual Bypassing by Robert Augustus Masters, and he talks a little bit about the idea that we can actually use spirituality as a way to avoid processing our emotions, and doing so is one of the things that can leave us open to being both an aggressor as well as being a passive victim. And so it's interesting because I found that spirituality is one of those things that can be used in a lot of different ways. It can be used for really benevolent and good things. And it also seems like spiritual practices can be used for harm. And so it becomes a really personal journey and process to understand our own spirituality and ways that we're using it out of love and ways that we might be using it to control or manipulate. And I have found that one of the best ways to protect ourselves and our own families from abuse is to learn about those shadows within ourselves, to really start to learn about where do we subtly try to manipulate and control other people and how does that happen. It makes us much more able to see it in other people. And I found that one of the best ways to do that is to get some help. So being a therapist, I didn't have the wonderful opportunity of going to therapy before I became a professional. And after I did, I really saw how having someone see things from the outside could be such a benefit. It can also be, you have to find your right fits, because I also find, just like spiritual bypassing, we can do therapy bypassing, using therapy to avoid the things we need to really look at. But if you can find a good fit and have someone, you know, help you to work through where are my own shadows of aggressiveness, sometimes they're in our own minds towards ourselves, where are my own shadows of being passive and not looking at the things that are harmful in my life, doing that is one of the best things you can do for your children, your grandchildren, and yourself. So there's let's see. So I was going to say that, you know, one of the disadvantages of using things like, and actually I'm going to just skip that for a minute. So one of the things I found in my own work is that abuse really is a coping mechanism. So when someone is a perpetrator, it's information that they are coping with something that has not been looked at in their own life. So if their emotions, you know, I went to a conference once, and the trainer, who's a colleague of mine and has done years of trauma work, one one of the things that she suggested was that if our emotions rise above about a 3 or 4 on a scale of 0 to 10, that's information that we're probably in the past. That, you know, 99% of the time, when our emotions rise above a 3 or 4, we are triggered by something that hasn't been looked at, that occurred in the past. So the emotion is still with us, it's still present. And so suddenly, what might be mildly annoying becomes enraging. And so for perpetrators or abusers, you know, it's a coping mechanism, and it's information that there's work for them to do in looking at some things in their life. And in a similar vein for victims, and in no way does the victim cause abuse. So I'm not a believer that a victim causes someone else to abuse them. But I do find that those who are passive and hold secrets also have unprocessed, usually, things from their past. There's fears that lead them to believe it's safer to hold things secret. So I love the question you brought up for bishops, which is, do you believe there's anything in your life that you should be keeping secret? I mean, that was a brilliant question. And so, because if that's happening, you know, there's no way for anyone outside of the little bubble environment, there's no way for anyone to know that abuse is happening. And, you know, we can learn about how to look for flags and all sorts of things with the people we love, but, you know, some people are very good at hiding things. And it's not until either the victim or the perpetrator comes out, or until they get caught by someone who can't see it, that this stuff can come out sometimes. And I've worked with clients who, gosh, they came in and they told me their story, and that they are no longer hurting their spouse, and here's what's been happening. And then their spouse comes in and says, no, actually, I'm still being hurt. You know, and I'll look at the perpetrator and ask, you know, do you understand what your partner's saying here? Would you agree with that? And, you know, eyes down on the floor. Yeah. It's like, wow, you know, so perpetrators can get very good at lying, very good at deceiving. And so just because someone tells us something does not mean it's true. And that's, you know, so if you're working in a church setting with a couple and the stories are different, just pay attention. You know, the reality is sometimes it takes time to get enough information about what the truth is. And just because someone has a lot of emotion and tears and is saying that something is true doesn't mean it necessarily is. So one of the things that I think is also really important, and I have seen this in both the work I do with abuse as well as the work I do with addictions, which is oftentimes these patterns are perpetuated through the emotion of shame. And so shame becomes the thing that keeps things secret. It also tends to be one of the things that keeps the emotions heightened enough that people do disassociate from reality and harm other people. And often after someone commits abuse, they'll feel bad, and they'll promise they're never gonna do it again, and they'll, you know, try to make a lot of promises and offer a lot of love, and then the pattern will happen again. So this is, again, where getting in and seeing someone can really be a benefit. And while I found that some bishops can be wonderful counselors and support, it really can be helpful to get in and see a professional, because we tend to shame abuse so much in our culture. But again, when it's a coping mechanism, shaming really isn't helpful. Much more helpful is, let's get you in and let's get some help. So even telling someone that, you know, you're the reason your wife has left you or your husband has left you, you know, you're the abuser, you're the one that broke the covenants, I find is just not helpful, because the reality is they're in a lot of pain as well. Otherwise, they would not be committing the abuses that they are. And in working with a victim, it's also really important to not shame them into staying. And so even if the perpetrator is feeling guilt and shame for what they did, that is their piece to work through. That is a good reason to get in and get help. But to use the victim as a way to try to heal the abuser's shame is not at all helpful. And so the victim will have their own guilt and shame and pain that needs to be looked at, and that becomes their piece that they can do some healing work around, so that they have the courage in the future to no longer keep secrets. But finding someone who can see both of those positions, the abuser and the perpetrator, with compassion, with understanding, and seeing the facts for what they are, and getting both people help, I believe is a huge piece. And yeah, there's all sorts of levels. So some people are abused in very severe, overt ways. Other people are abused in very mild, subtle ways. There's emotional abuse, there's psychological abuse, sexual abuse. I mean, there are so many layers and levels. And my personal perspective is we all can be, in certain ways, abusers, and we all can be victims. But for some of us, it's more overt, and for some of us, it's much more subtle and in ways that it's not necessarily as harmful. And for those who go through long-term abuse, like Terry was saying, there's that vulnerability to PTSD, post-traumatic stress, and a complex PTSD, which comes from a situation that have been abusive over time. So I think that's everything for my initial presentation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Transitioned into academic research on the subject. So I come at this particular issue from a different paradigm, and I think you'll probably see that throughout my presentation. I do want to state just at the moment, because this came up a couple of times in the previous session, that my work has been almost exclusively with women, and I have counseled hundreds of Mormon women over my 8 years doing this kind of work. And like I said, it's almost exclusively women. That being said, I want to acknowledge right from the beginning that abuse does happen to men. And though my presentation is mostly focused at women, you can go ahead and in your particular situation, if it applies to you, also apply it to your experience as a man with abuse. Okay. So, that being said, let's move on. Thinking about what I wanted to share in this presentation, I was struck by Terry's last paragraph in his paper, where he says, "The church condemns abuse in strong, unequivocal rhetoric, but it does not meet the full measure of the need to protect present and future generations of women, the sanctity of temples, or the reputation of the church. Examined in the whole, the policy for responding to abuse is sometimes ambiguous. More could be done to educate members to avoid abusive relationships, to train local leaders for response to abusive relationships, and to hold abusers accountable." So we're going to use that particular paragraph from Terry's paper as the roadmap for this part of the presentation. So as Terry mentioned, there really is not good data about domestic violence victims in the LDS community. Like I said, I have counseled hundreds of domestic violence victims over my almost a decade of doing this work, on average about 2 per month. So take from that what you will. You can also kind of look at statistics from Utah to give an idea. This is not perfect data by any means, but it gives you a little sense of what is happening in a state that is still a majority LDS. So you can look at some of the statistics up on the board. For time's sake, I probably won't go over them. So there is a wonderful report done on domestic violence in Utah that looks at the community aspect of what this particular community is doing in response to domestic violence. And there's one particular point that I think this quite interests me. So when victims were asked who they would report their violence to, you can see from the chart there that the number one source that victims go to report their violence is to family members, where they feel the most support. Next, they go to law enforcement to try and get some type of response from the criminal justice system. The very last is their ecclesiastical leaders, at almost 15%. And then victims who... So the first number was a report of all Utah women asking who they would go to see. If to report their abuse. Victims who then were surveyed then said that only 22% of them went to go see their bishop. And I think that that is interesting, and I think, this report then outlines some of the reasons why that is. So we've talked about this a little bit in both this session and previous session, but some of these reasons are not believing the perpetrator, or not believing the victim and siding with the perpetrator. We had a sister over here who said that her bishop had believed her husband because he had the priesthood. So there was lack of follow-through, inconsequential retribution for the perpetrator. Terry covered that extensively in his presentation. The male domination of the system. It can be very difficult as a woman who's been abused by a man to go into a closed office with another man and report abuse. That's just one of those things that's very difficult for victims. And then you can go through the rest of that, but often it comes down to there's a lack of understanding, or they just don't particularly want to deal with the issue. And of course, this, I'm not trying to generalize to all bishops. I happen to be married to a bishop, and I think bishops do really important work, but there are some bishops that have historically been unsupportive of victims of domestic violence. So I want to give you some stories from sisters within our community that have experienced this and have experienced some kind of failure from the church in response to their domestic violence. And I want to emphasize that these are our sisters. These are women who are among us, in our pews, in our relief societies, in our book groups, our neighbor across the street, the women we chat with in the hallway of our children's schools. These are our sisters, and we are failing them as a community. I do want to say here that if you are sensitive to these kind of stories, this is a trigger warning, because some of these are hard to listen to. And also, I should state that all of these stories are shared with permission. So I have had a woman I counseled who said that after years of horrendous abuse, she finally went to her bishop. She got up the courage to go to her bishop, and her bishop told her that she couldn't divorce him because her boys needed a father, and that was more important than her safety. She eventually decided that she could no longer live in the nightmare that she was living in, and she left. She ended up in a domestic violence shelter. Her husband received no disciplinary action. For those of you who have ever been in a shelter, I worked in one, it's a very difficult environment, and you can see why this woman would be devastated that her community failed her, that her husband received no punishment, that she was not supported, and she felt like she had lost everything. This is a horrendous story of a woman who, on her honeymoon, was beaten by her new husband because she didn't want to go to the restaurant that he went to, or he wanted to go to. Luckily for her, she had supportive family who got there in time and rescued her from the situation. She was one of the lucky ones where she was able to get a cancellation of her ceiling. That is not something that happens in a wide variety of cases, but she was lucky that she was able to get one. But once again, her husband, who was arrested, there was absolute proof. She was in the hospital with many severe injuries, he received no punishment. This woman here was attacked physically and sexually by her college boyfriend, and her roommate took her to the hospital and called the police. And the roommate was actually then called into the bishop's office and reprimanded that she should not have gotten the local authorities involved in the case, that she should have let the church handle it. He took away this roommate's temple recommend and released her from her calling as Relief Society president without a replacement. The boyfriend, who was in the same ward, did not have his temple recommend taken away, but he was forced to forgo the sacrament for a month. So, as you see at the bottom there, the actual victim, didn't feel like she could turn to her bishop for support in this horrendous experience because he had proven himself to be uncompassionate and vindictive. This woman here said that she had experienced severe emotional and physical abuse, that her husband had been arrested several times, and yet bishops continued to give him callings and to give him temple recommends. And when she went to go see them, they would often blame her for the abuse and say that she was not taking care of his needs, and that she was complicit in the abuse that was being perpetrated against her. This last woman was married to a man who was in recovery for a narcotics addiction. And unfortunately, he fell off the wagon, and with that came a return of some abusive behaviors. And she states that one night that she went into her room, she had gone to her bishop previously, and the bishop had told her that her marriage was very important, that she needed to try harder, and to be more understanding of her husband because he was stressed from losing his job because he was a drug addict. So she went into her bedroom one night after a severe session of emotional abuse, and he had a gun in his hand. And she quickly fled from the home with her young children, went to a friend's house. The friend called the police. There they found 6 handguns and a duffel bag full of illegal drugs. He was committed because he was suicidal and homicidal. And there he stated that he blamed his wife for his situation, that he threatened to kill her, and explained to the staff how he was going to do this, how he was going to dispose of her body. Despite knowing this, the bishop still continued to counsel her to prioritize her marriage. So these are actual stories. These are women that I have talked to and counseled with. These are our sisters. And there is no excuse for this. That being said, I believe that it's important to put some context behind this and to understand maybe why, as a community, we are failing this vulnerable population. And this is controversial. I understand it's controversial. As a domestic violence researcher, I have done the research into violence in religious communities, and it's been shown over and over again that in communities where there is very strict and traditional gender roles, those who are predisposed to violence and misogyny will use that as an excuse to perpetrate their violence. So Terry talked a little bit about the temple and about the doctrine of eternal marriage. And this is a beautiful doctrine of our church, one of the most important. And I think he explained that bishops and state presidents really don't want to break up these marriages. And they don't want to be the one who says, yes, absolutely, you should leave, you should end this marriage, because it not only has ramifications for the current situation, but it has ramifications for the eternal progress of both people and the children involved. So it's understandable why many local leaders would be hesitant about counseling to end a relationship like this. The proclamation on the family. In one hand, it's a lovely document, but it also has this line, by divine design, fathers are to preside over their family in love and righteousness. Now, those of us in this room who care about this issue see the love and righteousness as the most important part of that statement. But somebody who is predisposed to violence may choose preside as the most important aspect of that particular sentence. And even though our church leaders have condemned abuse and have told us that we are supposed to be in equal partnerships, may take that preside to mean something other. There are many different definitions to the word preside, and we need to be cognizant of what somebody who's predisposed to violence may do with that particular word. This also goes to temple language. The temple language has been softened over the past 25 years, and I don't really want to get into this, but once again, where some of us find beauty and empowerment and a model to create healthy, beautiful relationships, there are people who will use some of that language to believe that they have power over their lives. It does not mean that that is what the church intends or that they are interpreting that right, but it is a fact and it's borne out by many of the conversations I've had with victims of domestic violence. And then, of course, we have a male-only priesthood in leadership. And whether you think that's by divine design or not, it does send a message that men are supposed to lead. And you can do that as you will, but once again, for those who believe in a particular way, it can provide reason for their abuse and for their belief that they have the right to power and control over their partner. Okay, so that was depressing. Let's take a deep breath. What do we do from here? And I think that's really important because this topic, you can start to feel really hopeless in being able to affect change and to make things better. So it's important to know what to do. And I think the good news is that we are perfectly situated to do some really wonderful things for victims of intimate partner violence. So we've talked quite a bit about this, and Terry mentioned this specifically, but I think comprehensive education in many different populations and age groups within the church would go a long way to ending domestic violence within our community. So, giving young women assertiveness training, I think that it was Lisa who said it can be difficult for girls to know how to stand up and how to lead men, or to even say, no, I don't like what's happening to me. We need to teach our girls to be assertive. We kind of prioritize the nice girl in our community. And there's nothing wrong with being a nice girl, but we also need to teach our daughters that they have a right to say no, and they have the right to be safe. And we need to teach them how to do that. That's not necessarily a learned skill. A healthy relationship course would be wonderful for both young men and for young women, where we teach them exactly what a healthy relationship looks like. We have a manual right now that many engaged couples or married couples go to, but I think we need one that's specifically targeted towards teens who are starting the dating process and who are looking to build the most important relationship of their life. And then also, we need to make sure that women are not necessarily making themselves more vulnerable than they need to be. We need to encourage women and girls to find skills that they can feel passionate about, but also support themselves if they want to and if they need to. Moving on to young men, we need to teach young men not to be violent. And that seems self-obvious. I have three sons, and I'm constantly telling them, please don't hit. But there is a culture where, especially if you are predisposed to believe that men have power over women, we need to tell these boys, you can't use your power to hurt another person, especially your wife and your children. Like I said, a healthy relationship course would be good here. And then
using priesthood to serve. We need to focus on the service aspect of priesthood rather than the power aspect of it. And if for anybody who wants to question me later, we can totally go into that. I know it's tricky considering our culture. Couples doing any kind of marriage preparation or marriage classes afterwards would go a long way. Once again, teaching couples what a healthy relationship looks like. The image here is the power and control wheel and the equality wheel, which kind of explicates what a dysfunctional relationship looks like and what a healthy relationship looks like. And then local leaders. I think we've all talked about this. A DD 101 training would go a long way to solving some of the heartache that we're seeing in the community. Like I said, I'm married to a bishop, so I have the opportunity to ask, what kind of training are you getting on this? And he's not getting any training. And for something that is as complex and difficult as this issue, I think it's unconscionable that we are not training our leaders to deal with this issue in an effective and compassionate way. We need to realize that the Spirit doesn't guide us in all things, and that sometimes it's okay to call a professional in. And we have some wonderful professionals up here that would be good. I think we'll take questions at the end. So I think one of the common prescriptions is for couples to be sent to marriage counseling, and I think that's really wonderful. As Jenny said, though, often in these situations, she's hearing two different stories, and so bishops need to be intuitive and realize when that's appropriate. It may be appropriate at first to send a perpetrator to counseling by himself before they start on marriage therapy. And of course, most importantly, do not be from blame. Okay, so creative solutions. I think these are really some of the most exciting. And I have a wonderful quote up here by a Latina advocate for domestic violence, where she says, faith and spirituality can provide us with a new foundation for our work by shifting our perspective of what is possible. Spirituality provides people with an alternative lens to deterministic visions of reality, which constantly try to tell us that there's no alternative to the oppressive reality that we live in. So, thinking about some of the things that we could do as a community to address domestic violence, I think there may be some exciting opportunities that fit pretty well with things that we currently are doing. So the first is a restorative justice model, and maybe some of you have heard of this, but this is an idea where the community comes together to support the victim and hold the perpetrator accountable. Now, we have something kind of like this in our disciplinary councils, but this needs to be broadened. Or it could be broadened so that we're providing support for victims, so include women in these. Part of holding the abuser accountable is that they feel the guilt and shame of what they've done. And so you have, you know, the Relief Society president saying, when you abuse your wife, this is how it affects our community of sisterhood. This is the sorrow that you have placed on our Relief Society. And you have the bishop saying, this is the sorrow that you have put upon our ward community. And you have the victim saying, this is the sorrow that you put upon me and our children. And the research is still kind of in development, but this looks like a fairly effective way to hold abusers accountable, in some cases to keep families together, where appropriate, obviously. So it's an interesting thing to consider. Batterer intervention. We have an addictions model already. We have AA groups and pornography addiction groups that we send men to, usually. We could add a batterer intervention where we talk about the dynamics of violence and we talk about the past that they're bringing in to their abusing. I think that this particular intervention is best paired with other interventions to help solve the underlying problem. And then we need to
think about self-sufficiency for victims. For those who can't stay in these very dangerous relationships, we need to think about what we can do to help them be self-sufficient. So we have the wonderful perpetual education fund. We could expand that to include women who maybe didn't get a chance to go to school or to finish their degree. Help them finish their degree so that they can be self-sufficient. We have an LDS employment service. Expand the job training services so that these women can find employment. And then Elder Anderson has been a real proponent of family-friendly work policies. And I think that we as a society and a community need to lobby for these family-friendly work policies, for affordable housing, all of those things that are real barriers for women becoming self-sufficient. So I believe that our culture really can do good work in this arena, but we need to have the bravery to address this complex issue and the fortitude to address it head on and be creative about the solutions that we come up with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nathan, Jenny, and Lisa. We'll ask for questions from the audience in just a second. I had one question for Jenny. I'm not sure that I understood. I'm sure I heard correctly. I have bad ears. But you said something about using the victim to heal the perpetrator is not helpful. Could you expand on that? I'm not sure what you mean by it.
So I think what I sometimes see, you know, when a bishop counsels someone to stay in the marriage or to not leave, even if there's a threat of emotional or physical or sexual violence, I guess one of the things I really looked at is why do people do that? Why does someone encourage a victim to stay? And there could be multiple reasons. I think sometimes what happens is because bishops are generally men, there tends to, well, actually, they're always men. So since bishops are men, sometimes who they identify with is the man, most frequently. And if there is some kind of, you know, because the abuser does tend to carry so much shame and guilt often after the fact, often the bishop will see that guilt and shame and identify with it, maybe on some level, being from the same gender, and encourage the woman to stay, partly because, marriage is the most important thing, but I do think that sometimes there's a little bit of what we call therapy counter-transference, meaning they see the perpetrator in some way as, if I were in that situation, I hurt my wife, I feel really bad about it, so she should stay and you guys can work it out. And so that's one of the perspectives that I think sometimes keeps people counseling victims to stay and realizing the man does feel shame and he's going to feel that. And that's an important thing for him to get help for because that will be one of the things that helps him to heal his pattern of abuse. But to have a victim stay to help him heal that is not a helpful thing, and setting up those boundaries is really, really important.
Thank you very much. We have 20 minutes left. I have several things I want to ask the panelists, but you came. I'm sure you want to ask questions, so we'll give you first crack at it here now.
I'm just going to have the microphone, so if anybody would like to. Jenny, you said that there were two books that you recommend, and I heard the first one on spiritual bypassing, but I didn't hear the second one.
The second one is a book by a woman named Marlene Winnell, and it's called Leaving the Fold, and it's written for people who are transitioning in their religious perspectives or even transitioning in their religion. I forget what religious background she comes from. But even if you're choosing to stay in a religious perspective, it can be helpful just looking at how religion can be used to block our emotional processing rather than taking accountability and facing the things we need to face emotionally and otherwise. So it's just an interesting perspective.
And I have a comment about men who are abused and feel shame. That is not always the case.
No,
for someone who is an ongoing perpetrator over time and maybe a sociopath, you can look up the definition. Or antisocial personality, they don't feel shame. They learn the game of looking shameful and guilty, which then engages the vulnerability to that on the part of the person who's they're confronting, whether it's their spouse or whether it's a bishop or whether it's someone else. So that's a really crucial piece, I think, for us who are helping to understand.
Can I respond real quickly?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that is true. When you're working with a psychopath in extreme conditions, they actually cannot often feel anymore. Or maybe they really never could. There could be some things going on in the brain where they're not able to feel. And I've worked with, you know, like I said, thousands of clients now, and that's a very, very rare experience. So people can be narcissistic and they can have psychopathic tendencies, but one of the things I found is when I worked even with very severe clients, when they start to process and get down to what's really going on, there's often a lot of shame. And when it starts to come out, it's one of the most terrifying things for someone who's been a perpetrator, especially if they have been disassociated for a lot of years from being able to feel. It would be a really terrifying experience for them to go through that. But I've rarely seen someone who was never able to tap into any of that feeling.
I was going to ask a question about narcissists and sociopaths. Thank you for raising that. Part of where I'm coming from on that is that I think bishops and state presidents need training in recognizing those disorders and dealing with them.
I think when it comes to emotional abuse, however, that there are many men who are blind because of the culture and they don't recognize that they're actually perpetuating emotional abuse, and then their wives complain. They really think it's a wife's perception problem. And I don't think that's just sociopathic personalities. I think that's what you're talking
about. And there's an interesting book on narcissism. I'll see if I can remember it, but it talks about how narcissism is actually a shame-driven response. So, a lot of this stuff in some of the research, we're really starting to look at how shame works, because it seems to be the most destructive emotion that we can experience. It makes us want to harm ourselves and others more than any other emotion.
Question over here.
It's always been my understanding that abusers rarely change. I was wondering if maybe, as professors, you can enlighten us on, have you seen abusers who have reached out for help and have been able to recognize their wrongdoing and then return back to healthy relationships?
So, as I said, in some of the solutions that we could come up with, specifically the batter intervention. Right now, in our governmental policy, along with arrest and jail time, batter intervention is the most prevalent intervention that we use to try and solve domestic violence. And that's kind of a feminist-based paradigm where it teaches men about the dynamics of violence as well as addresses their inherent misogyny. That has been proven really to be ineffective and not to help recidivism rates. And basically all of the interventions that we have in our society, none of them work. This is actually what I'm writing my thesis on right now. So, yes, you're right. Most batterers do not change. What research is finding, though, is that it's not so much the batter intervention or arrest that is making the difference. When perpetrators are forced to feel what they've done, when they're forced to feel the shame and the hurt of what they've done, and they feel the shame of the judgment of their community, that is more likely to stop their abuse than anything else. It's not necessarily because they've changed their paradigm and they believe that they don't have the right anymore to abuse their partner. It's because they don't want to feel the judgment of their community. Their community, staying in their community, is more important to them than perpetrating power and control over their loved ones. So that that looks to be the most effective intervention, but it's kind of a depressing one because it's not really changing hearts and minds. It's speaking to people's fears.
Which is why the restorative justice model that you presented is really the most effective. What we found in better interventions is that when you get a bunch of betterers together in a class to learn new principles, they end up supporting each other in their misogynistic. So it doesn't help. But what does help is holding the perpetrators accountable in tight ways, in ways only that a close community can. And the only model that will work is for, oh well, and here's a story I love. This comes from Shelley Thomas's book, The Tending Instinct, where in a village in Africa, when it's known in the vibes of the community that there's a man who's on the emotional warpath and his wife is going to be in danger, the women of the village will come to the hut of the woman who is at risk, and they will surround the hut with the woman inside, and they will not let the man in. They will not let the man anywhere near her until the danger is past. That's sort of the model here, that when there's a person who is out of control, the community steps in and says, we will not let this happen. She's given us enough information. We are taking a clear stand, and we will not let this happen. There are consequences that will happen to you, sir, if you so much as take a step this direction. When the community is prepared to step up in and perform some kinds of justice, we'll have a better chance.
And I think, too, for some reason, just the idea of cancer is coming up, because in my work, I have seen, you know, kind of miraculous sorts of healings, and it seems like if the abuser is abusing at a more severe level, and this is why I'm thinking of cancer, what are the phases of cancer called?
Stages.
Yeah. So if you're in a stage 4 cancer, your chance for healing is statistically lower. If you're in stage 1, it's statistically higher. And it's similar with abuse healing. If someone is in sort of a more mild form of abuse, then their chances for healing and really working through that is higher. If it's more severe, it's going to be more difficult for them ultimately to internally change. But it's not impossible, but I don't think sometimes we just don't know what the magic key is or who it is that's going to be able to get to that level of healing. So I think that is where community becomes really important, and stepping in, and whether or not the abuser can heal for themselves, maybe at least they can take accountability because it's what's being required of them.
Thank you. We've had a couple of new words, I think, thrown out. I'm interested in whether our panel have a common understanding of the term and the usage. And as you may know, terms that kind of have a way of evolving into something else, and the usage of it. We use the term batterers, and there's another term, barrage. And some counselors in my research use the term batterers not just for physical violence, but for verbal violence as well. And I'm not sure, but maybe barrage is more commonly associated with verbal. It's where, you know, what a barrage means, you know, you're just inundated with. Could panelists address that, please?
Yeah, I
haven't
thought
of
those words, actually, very much.
Batter is more of a domestic violence movement ward, although I don't think I've come across the word barrage in my studies of the literature, mainly because emotional abuse, if that's the only thing that's going on, that's more difficult to study because there isn't criminal justice intervention as well, generally.
Thank you. Do we have more questions?
Question.
I was just going to say, it sounds like, to be honest, the safest course is for a woman to get out of this situation.
You know, it's very complicated. It's a very complicated issue. This is why training is so important, because you have to be able to assess exactly what the lethality danger is. In some cases, absolutely, it is the most important thing for a woman to get safe. But you also have to remember that after a woman leaves a domestic violence, that statistically is the most dangerous time. More women statistically are murdered by their partner after they've left than when they're in the relationship. So you really have to be careful and to really assess what the danger is. Now, there are some women who don't want to leave for a variety of reasons, and those reasons are all complicated, and we need to validate those feelings. It doesn't help for us to tell a victim, you would just be better off leaving, and any other choice you make is the wrong one. That can also be traumatizing for a victim. And so we need to, for those of us who are advocates or therapists, we need to carefully discuss and assess with each different victim what exactly is going on in the relationship, why they want to stay in the relationship, and then go there to provide the counseling. The number one indicator of poverty in this country is for a woman to be a single mother. And so it's very difficult to feel like you're going to be safer leaving an abusive relationship if you're not going to have a roof over your head and you're not going to be able to feed your children. And so those are all things that we have to address. And of course, it's even more complicated when you're talking about communities of color, because they are generally even worse, underserved by the criminal justice system and by many of our human resource services. So these are all things that, as an advocate, you have to take into an account. And so, definitely, in some cases, absolutely, you should do everything to get the woman safe. But it's a very complex issue, and that's why training is really vital. And that's why we can't have well-meaning, well-intentioned leaders just saying, well, leave or don't leave, because it's much more complicated than that.
Thank you. This woman down here, while you're bringing the mic up, just a brief comment that one of the most common reasons that abuse victims give for remaining in the home and in the marriage is the children. And the flip side of that coin is that then they're exposing their children to that paradigm. And I don't criticize women who stay in the abuse. I take the attitude that only they can decide, but it's extremely difficult.
Hearing all these things is very overwhelming. Having lived through them is very overwhelming, and it sounds to me like many of the interventions we talk about are band-aids, and that the real problem is the inequality in our society, the inequality in the church, and lack of education about these issues, but just lack of education and lack of maturity, and the pressure to marry early, the pressure for women to marry instead of having education. All these issues make them so much more vulnerable. And I just wish that there could be more of a change in our culture here that valued women being mature and educated, able to support themselves, able to choose a better partner before they actually feel any pressure to do so. It's just so very sad.
How many agree with her basic statement there that the foundation is, or you know, the biggest part of the problem is our culture and the society? Thank you.
Any further questions?
Well, then we get out 3 minutes early. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it.